Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Carl Bogus, author of Madison's Militia, The Hidden History of the Second Amendment. It's published by Oxford University Press, and it will be released. It was just released. And it's at our bookstore. Carl's an attorney with a long career at firms here in Philly. He's a professor of law at Roger Williams School of Law. As an author, he's edited and contributed to the Second Amendment in Law and History. He's also written Why Lawsuits Are Good for America, and he's written a great biography of William F. Buckley, although they have completely different political viewpoints. He's contributed to The Nation, The Globe, The New York Times, USA Today, CNN. So his work in progress also, I might as well mention that, is more work on the Second Amendment, torts and products liability, which was my old specialty, the civil justice system, corporate control of democracy, and actually we could talk about ChatGPT and stuff like that, which everyone talks about. So the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed. It's probably the only amendment that the majority of Americans are aware of now. But we're not going to be concerned today with what the country thinks or the interpretation of the amendment by politicians and courts. No talk of AR-15s, assault weapons, bump stocks, the Brady Bill, gun locks, fingerprint triggers, or the 1619 Project. We're here to discuss how something came about and how something seemingly at the time so tangential has made such a difference in our interpretation of our country and its founding fathers. In order to maintain a well-regulated militia, what does that actually mean? And why did they stick it in there? So Carl delves into the question in a clear and precise manner. The nature of the compromise, the way I look at it, that led to this amendment, to a Bill of Rights that almost didn't exist, I had no idea. I mean, compromise, I'm reminded in this book, is basically the foundation of every government, at least one that has civil discourse, which we don't have anymore. And without that compromise, it's doubtful that a civilized society could even exist. Gun law as such, in its interpretation, has no place, at least in this book, but origins, intent, and personality does. And as we figure into that, this almost biographical delving into what we now basically refer to as simply guns, and with the weapon, control of same, and then James Madison, Patrick Henry, Washington, even Jefferson, mostly are all slave owners. So it's exciting. So here to tell us how we got to this place is Carl. Welcome, Carl. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sam. It's really a pleasure to be here, and thank you for having me.
So here's something. You begin with slave rebellions, and at first, like most lay people, I'm going, why is he starting with this? You know, the Carolinas, and then Jamaica. So explain why you thought it was important as a foundation to bring those concepts and really interesting stories to light for us.
Yes. So the Second Amendment is expressly tied to the militia. You read it, and it starts out by saying a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And so it's tied to the militia. And the question is, in 1789, when Madison and the First Congress drafted this, and in 1791, when it was ratified by state legislatures, what was the militia? Why was the militia important? And why was there a concern about the militia being armed? What led to that? And my thesis in the book is that the militia then, following the Revolutionary War, was good for just one thing. It was very effective for slave control. It was absolutely essential for slave control. And contrary to kind of the image we have in our mind of the Minuteman holding the musket on Lexington Green, the militia had been thoroughly and absolutely discredited as a military force during the Revolutionary War. So there was this concern about keeping the militia armed. The South needed an armed militia for slave control. Following the Revolutionary War, none of the American leaders believed the militia was a fighting force, a military force that could go toe-to-toe with a professional army. So they were concerned about keeping an armed militia for slave control. And the kind of the mystery deepens in why, what made them worried about a disarmed militia. And that's kind of where the book starts. And it, you mentioned it starts with the Stono Rebellion in 1730 something, I've forgotten the exact year, in South Carolina. But my thesis is the South was terrified of potential slave insurrections. They lived in constant fear of potential slave insurrections, and that's the backdrop.
In some states, the white people were the minorities, in one specifically.
At least within certain large areas of states. So I think if you take all of Virginia, the white population was about maybe 60%, the black population, 40%. But if you take Eastern Virginia, the Tidewater region where Washington lived and George Mason lived, and Richmond, Virginia was, which becomes important to the story, that was majority enslaved blacks. And the same is true if you take Eastern South Carolina. It was majority population were enslaved blacks. And so even in other parts where blacks weren't the majority, they represented a large segment of the population. And keeping them in control,
excuse me,
was essential for the South.
You know, I was listening when I was listening to the debate between you and the guy from the Federalist Society at the Constitutional Center, and you began by saying this is one of the most important stories that no one knows about, which I didn't know about. So I guess we should travel to Virginia and tell that story.
Yep. So here's the story, and I do think it's one of the most dramatic stories in American history, and yet also one of the least known stories in American history. Someday somebody will make a great movie about this.
It would be a great movie.
It's got all of the drama. So what happened was the founders come out of Independence Hall in 1787, and they present a constitution. And some woman famously asked Ben Franklin, "Dr. Franklin, what have you given us?" And he said, a republic if you can keep it. But the Constitution, by its own terms, would only come into being and only be effective if it was ratified by 9 states. At ratifying conventions, the founders in Philadelphia knew that the professional politicians in the state legislatures would not want to give up state power to a new national government that was going to be powerful. And so they required that the states consider whether to ratify the Constitution at ratifying conventions with delegates elected specifically for that purpose. And by the time we get to June of the following year of 1788, a ratifying convention is convened in Richmond. And everything, Sam, was on the line, because it appeared at that point that if Virginia did not ratify, there wouldn't be a ninth state ratifying. Eight states had ratified, but Rhode Island was definitely not going to ratify. And it didn't look like New Hampshire, New York, or North Carolina were going to ratify either. They were all, at best, highly uncertain. So the drama in Richmond at this ratifying convention is huge. If Virginia doesn't ratify, there may not be a new United States of America and a new constitution. And even if there is a ninth state, it's by no means clear the United States can survive without Virginia. It was the largest state, the most populous state, the wealthiest state, the home to Washington, Jefferson, Madison, et cetera. And it's right there in the middle. What was left wouldn't be contiguous without Virginia. So everything's on the line. And to make this more dramatic, the leaders of the two factions, the Federalists who want to ratify and the Anti-Federalists who don't want to ratify, are led at this convention by luminaries of the time and of our time today. So the Federalists are led by James Madison, supported by John Marshall, who goes on to be a famous Supreme Court justice, and Harry Lighthorse Lee, who was a hero of the Revolutionary War, and they're opposed by the Anti-Federalists, who are led by Patrick Henry, who was considered the greatest living American orator of the time, and George Mason, who was considered kind of the brainchild of the Anti-Federalists, not to mention young and upcoming James Monroe, a future president, who is also supporting the Anti-Federalists. So you've got a showdown, a clash between titans that lasts just about an entire month. And one last thing that, from our point today, makes it so intriguing is, quite unusually, we've got a pretty good transcript of the month-long debate, which is highly unusual. And so that's why it's so dramatic. And as it turns out, things happen at Richmond that I believe causes Madison to go off later and write a Bill of Rights and include in the Bill of Rights what we today call the Second Amendment.
Well, when I talked about compromise, I really couldn't figure out, I mean, was Madison, well, first of all, who knew that oratory was so important? And if you get sick and can't speak, it might be the pivotal point of the month. And then, you know, you don't have Twitter, you don't have newspapers that had sent people the news that happened that day. So it's right there in this one room. And the way someone spoke, especially if you're dealing with Patrick Henry, it made such a difference. And you made that so clear in the book, is, you know, we were on a seesaw, which we could have gone either way.
Yes. Yep. And it gets decided by a very thin vote at the end. Nobody knew how this was going to turn out. It was very close. And it was a heck of a big deal at the time. They first convened at the State House, and there were crowds that wanted to come in. People then went to watch live events for the oratory. They went to see court cases when a lawyer who was considered to be a great orator was speaking. And that's what actually made Patrick Henry famous in the beginning. He was a lawyer, and he gained a reputation as a great orator. in trials later in the state legislature with his, you know, among other things, with his famous "Give me liberty or give me death" speech. But you're absolutely right about that. And how everything turns out depends a lot on the serendipity of the event, who's on their game that day, who is particularly persuasive. Madison got sick during the month, and he was not at his best at times. Patrick Henry, at one point during a massive thunderstorm, seems to call down heaven for on his side. And as he does it, thunder and lightning burst out at a dramatic moment, and delegates actually ran from the hall in fear. So, I mean, you've actually got, it just doesn't get more dramatic.
There's so many good stories, you know, especially about Washington trashing the militia when they ran away, and his backstory letters, because he didn't want to be there, but he wanted to make sure everyone knew. So we can't obviously talk about all of them, but talk about the one where Patrick Henry thought he had someone in, you know, the corner, painted somebody in a corner, and then it turned and backfired.
Yes. So Edmund Randolph, who was at that moment the governor of Virginia, Patrick Henry had been the first governor of Virginia, and I believe that you couldn't succeed yourself as governor of Virginia. So there had to be a new governor every year. You could come back later. And Henry winds up being governor of Virginia on multiple occasions. But what happened was Edmund Randolph had been a delegate to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. And he was one of three delegates who refused to sign the Constitution. And so the Anti-Federalists are hoping and expecting that he's going to be on their side in the Richmond Convention. He was the governor, he was highly popular, and he was also a great speaker. So they were looking forward to being supported by Randolph. Meanwhile, surreptitiously, Madison's been working on Randolph. And he gets Randolph to slip into favor ratification. And so when Randolph announces during the convention that he's in favor of ratifying the Constitution, it is a great surprise. And Patrick Henry is convinced that something nefarious has happened, that Randolph has been paid off somehow. He's been given something, that there is some kind of self-interest going on. And Henry's also the master of innuendo, and he implies this in more than one speech. Henry spoke more than anybody else, and he was frequently on his feet speaking. And at one time, he speaks nonstop for 7 hours, the entire day. But anyway, so he's harping on this with Randolph, and he goes a little too far and suggests that Randolph is not candid, which in 18th century aristocratic America was a serious charge. It cut to the quick somebody's, it attacked their virtue. And this is the time when there were duels. And Randolph gets quickly on his feet, and he makes remarks that end with something that sounds cryptic by 2023 standards. He says, "If our friendship falls, let it fall like Lucifer," or something along that line, but he invokes Lucifer's name, which was then understood to be challenged to a duel. "You have insulted my integrity, and I'm challenging you to a duel." And this is the current governor of the state, challenging the prior governor of the state to a duel. I mean, it's quite something. I'm sure the chamber was deadly silent. And Henry quickly backs off. Henry's in his 50s, which in that time was kind of elderly. Randolph is in his 30s. Randolph was a war veteran. He knew his way around firearms. Henry wasn't. A duel wasn't going to probably go well for Patrick Henry. And so he backs off. But that is how pointed the debate came. It literally almost came more than two blows to an actual lethal event.
I'm not going to bring us into the present too much because that's not what your book does, but it reminds me of something that, like, Trump will do. He will do to DeSantis as they move along, but he'll do it way, way worse. And then he has no proof, of course. And that reminds me, when we're talking about oratory of Trump, oratory of Biden, it's of course, everything is like, you couldn't make this stuff up. It's been that way since 2015. But it's like, when, remember when Obama was eloquent and the Republicans said, you know, he uses too many words?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So there is all of that. And there are some interesting reminders here that maybe the times we live in, because every time is unique, but there are some precursors. There's a lot of conspiracy thinking and conspiracy mongering on the part of the anti-federalists here to defeat the ratification. And so now we get to the some of the arguments that Henry and George Mason raised to defeat ratification. And here's the essence of their argument on this topic, which was one of their major topics, one of their major points of attack. They said, in essence, the following. James, you tell us, James Madison. You call him James. James, you tell us that you and your colleagues at Philadelphia wrote a constitution that does not give Congress the ability to eliminate slavery, to abolish slavery. And we'll accept that. There's a slave compromise written into the Constitution that's somewhat encoded, but everybody agrees it doesn't give the national government the ability to abolish slavery. So we accept that. But here's what you did, James. You gave Congress the ability to subvert our slave system. And here's how you did it. Up until this moment, the militia, our instrument of slave control, has been controlled by the state governments. They're creatures of the state governments. And now you've written a constitution, unprecedented, in which you give the national government most of the power over the militia. Congress has the power to organize the militia any way it sees fit. It has the power to arm the militia, and it has the power to discipline the militia, that is, train the militia and provide rules and regulations for the militia. All we're left with is the power to appoint officers and to train the militia in accordance with the discipline prescribed by Congress. So you've given all of this power to the federal government, to the national government, which is going to wind up being controlled by the North. North is growing faster than we are. Well, here's what they're going to do. They've got the power to arm the militia, which means they have the power to disarm the militia. And if they leave us with a disarmed militia, what's going to happen? They didn't have to spell out what's going to happen. What's going to happen is we're going to have slave revolts and slave insurrections, and we're completely vulnerable. They also came up with some other kind of bizarre thinking. They might take Georgia's militia and march it to New Hampshire. To which I think it's Randolph who gets up and says, it's just the reverse. It's just the reverse. If anybody needs help from other states' militia, it's us because of our situation, because we've got slaves here. Now, Henry was no fool. He was a lawyer and a good lawyer by all accounts. But he was more of he appealed to emotion. He was like the jury lawyer, a lawyer for a jury. He could move people emotionally and did. Madison, on the other hand, and he had a booming voice. He was 6 feet tall. He was dramatic. He would have long pauses. He would look to heaven. He would do all kinds of things. Madison was brilliant. And nobody knew the Constitution better than Madison. He was a delegate to the convention. He didn't miss a moment of the convention. He took copious notes of the convention. He knew the Constitution inside out much better than Henry. But as you noted, how people are feeling, he was kind of ill in the middle of this event. And he gets up and he makes what sounds reasonable on the surface, but turns out to be just a fatal error. And he says, look, if Congress doesn't arm our militia, we'll just arm it ourselves. It's a concurrent power. We'll just arm our militia. And Henry ridicules him. Really, James? So you wrote a constitution that parcels out all of these powers, some to the national government, some to the state government. And now you're telling us that doesn't mean anything? All these powers are concurrent? Congress has the power to arm the militia, so do we. We have the power to appoint officers to the militia, so does Congress. It's nonsensical. And it was.
When I was a younger, just graduating law school, I wrote a letter to Wayne LaPierre. And I said, this prefatory clause is meaningless. There is no, I didn't know about slavery. I thought that the well-regulated militia was there to fight the British if they came back. And I said, it's meaningless. And he responded in some kind of ridiculous way. But it reminded me that, you know, what is the militia today? I'm taking you back, but I want to set the stage now. The militia today, the National Guard, the Reserve, okay. But you have the Oath Keepers and you have the Three Percenters. They present themselves as a militia and recognized as a militia in some fashion. What are they? And what would that have been considered back then? A group of people that armed themselves, called themselves a militia, but theoretically were controlled by what would be the federal government.
So prior to the Constitution, when the states were colonies, or when they were states under the Articles of Confederation, the militia were whatever the state government
determined
they were. And in some instances, state governments permitted private militia to organize. And in some instances, the militia were under governmental control. What the Constitution did is it doesn't leave the militia, what is it, open to debate. The main body of the Constitution defines what the militia is, gives Congress the power to organize it as Congress sees fit. And Congress has organized the militia into the National Guard system. As somebody who was in the National Guard for 6 years, I'm pretty aware of it.
Right.
So that's what it is. It's the government militia is the National Guard. it is available to provide for the security of the state, because if there is a riot, there is an insurrection, there is public arrest, unrest, there is some natural calamity, a hurricane or an earthquake, the governor can call up the militia and to provide for internal security of the state. But Congress can organize the militia as it sees fit, and Congress and the Constitution provides, when it's called in the federal service, the commander-in-chief of the militia is the president. And so that's what the militia is. It has been integrated into the armed forces. It's very much like the Army Reserve, with the exception that the governor can call up the militia, can't call up the Army Reserve. And that's what it is today. You can have people who want to self-deputize themselves on we're a militia organization, but they are not the militia that is the government regulated militia defined and provided for in the United States Constitution.
Well, you're liberal. I'm probably more liberal than you, but my opinions on, say, abortion, gun control have changed over the years, and I realize I don't think anyone would have assumed that a farmer can't have a rifle or a gun to shoot groundhogs or to hunt squirrels or to hunt or shoot deer. And that always raised a question with me. And, you know, and like I said at the beginning, you know, now it's guns, it's not arms, it's just guns, it's handguns, it's assault weapons. But how do you argue that the people do not have the right to bear arms, other than the infringement aspect of it, for purposes of recreation or hunting or protection?
Well, the United States Supreme Court in 2008 says that they do. But that is a brand new interpretation of the Second Amendment. So throughout the entire history of the Republic, from the time the Second Amendment was ratified in 1791 until 2008, the law was that the Second Amendment only pertains to guns in the militia. And we're talking about the militia of the Constitution, the militia organized by Congress. There were three Supreme Court cases over the years, and the most recent prior to 2008 was United States versus Miller in 1939. And those three Supreme Court cases all said that in some fashion or another, and all of the lower federal courts interpreted those cases as saying the Second Amendment is all about guns in the militia. Do people have a right to drink milk? Well, the Constitution doesn't provide that. Do people have a right to sleep on their left side? Well, the Constitution doesn't provide that. I don't know what the founders would have thought about legislation that forbade farmers to have guns in America. But I don't think they wrote a provision in the Constitution that protects that. And the Anglo-American tradition was that governments could highly regulate firearms. In Britain, only 2% of the population were permitted to own handguns, to own firearms, or actually arms. You know, offensive weapons, whether they were firearms or crossbows, only about 2%, it was based on your income and your socioeconomic status, could own guns, despite the fact that the right to have weapons comes from, the origin is, the English Declaration of Rights of 1689, which says that subjects who are Protestants may have arms as allowed by law, which meant Parliament can determine who can own arms and who can't and what arms they can own. That was the tradition. And the colonies did regulate arms. You know, I don't know, you can keep gunpowder at home. No, you have to keep gunpowder in the armory. They did have regulations. But the question isn't how sensible it would have been to create a law banning guns, banning milk, banning people from sleeping on your left side. The question is, what's in the Bill of Rights and what do each of those things mean? And until 2008, if there was ever settled constitutional law, it was the Second Amendment, that it protects, in essence, the rights of states to have armed militia to provide for their own security. Congress, you get to organize the militia, you get to arm the militia, but there is some bare minimum of an armed militia that a state may have to provide for its own internal security. And that's how it was understood.
Well, that brings us to a really interesting aspect of the book. Then again, lay people may not find easily accessible, which is that for many people, the preamble of the Constitution, and I won't read it all, but we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, feel that that obviated the need for a Bill of Rights. So this Second Amendment kind of dragged along the Bill of Rights with it. And so, yeah, they could have had an amendment that precluded you from drinking milk or precluded you from sleeping or precluded you from or designated the manner in which you serve boiled eggs, point side up, point side down, like Jonathan Swift said. But they didn't. But talk about how, you know, these guys were thinking, the Federalists, why do we even need this Bill of Rights? What's the point?
Yeah. So Whig ideology in England, which had a great influence on the American founders, the Whigs were kind of the liberals of Britain at the time. And Whig ideology held that liberty, freedom and liberty, is the right to live under laws that are made by your elected representatives. Parliament makes the laws, and that's what liberty is. Parliament will protect the people from abuse because they're elected by the people. And Madison was very much of the view, until post-Richmond, when Patrick Henry tries to extinguish his political career, Madison was very much of the view that writing a list of rights was a bad idea for at least two reasons. One was, Madison believed that the rights of the people are better protected through the structure of government, a governmental architecture that will protect the people than by a written list of rights. What Madison derided as parchment barriers, mere parchment barriers. You can write something down on a list, but that doesn't protect you. What really protects you is the way government is designed. And secondly, Madison believed, you can't write a complete list of rights.
Exactly.
And so if you try to write a list of rights, you can only put so many things on. And if you leave off, people have a right to drink milk. People have a right to sleep on their left side. People have a right to eat boiled eggs with a small end up. If you leave those off, people will say it's not a right. It's not protected. So he was opposed to a written Bill of Rights until Henry basically forces Madison to run for Congress by having the state legislature select two other men to represent Virginia in the United States Senate. People thought, at least Madison's friends and allies thought, well, if Virginia's going to send two Virginians to the United States Senate, certainly James Madison's going to be one. He's our the single most influential person in writing the Constitution, and our greatest state, one of our greatest statesmen.
And the Federalist Papers.
But Henry, who is an arch enemy of Madison, Madison is in favor of a strong national government. Henry is absolutely opposed to a strong national government. He either wants Virginia to be sovereign and go its own way, or perhaps it was rumored to create a confederation of southern states instead. So this basically forces Madison to run for the seat in the House of Representatives. And then Patrick Henry gerrymanders Madison's congressional district. He has Virginia pass a law that says you can only run for Congress in the congressional district in which you reside. By the way, a law that subsequently has been ruled unconstitutional, because the Constitution says you have to be a member of the state, not a member of the congressional district, to run for Congress. But anyway, he passes a law. You can only run for Congress from the congressional district in which you live. He gerrymanders the congressional district in which Madison lives to pack in anti-federalist counties and precincts. And then he recruits James Monroe, this 30-year-old rising star, to run against Madison. And Monroe decides, everybody recognized the way to run against Madison is run on a Bill of Rights, which was the idea of a Bill of Rights was popular, especially in anti-federalist areas. So Monroe's going to say, I'm in favor of a Bill of Rights. Madison is opposed to a Bill of Rights. Select me. And Madison's in a bind. He is in a bind. He goes through a lot of hand-wringing. He writes letters to his friend Thomas Jefferson, wringing his hands about this. But then he flips and he says, I was against the Bill of Rights before we had a ratified Constitution. Now the Constitution's been ratified, I'm entirely in favor of a Bill of Rights. And if you elect me, I'll go to Congress, I'll write one, and I'll do my best to get Congress to adopt it and propose it to the states. And so that's what he does. He does get elected. And when he gets to Congress, nobody except him really is interested in the Bill of Rights. Congress is 90% of Congress, more than 90% of Congress are Federalists who oppose the Bill of Rights. And even the few anti-Federalists there, they're not that interested in a Bill of Rights either. They were making a lot of hullabaloo of a Bill of Rights as a means of defeating the Constitution, not ratifying it. And they're not in favor of writing a bill, having Congress write a Bill of Rights. They take up the idea that only a new constitutional convention should write a Bill of Rights, because what they want is a new convention to undo the work that was done by the founders in Philadelphia. But Madison prevails, and he does write a Bill of Rights, and he never tells us why he writes a Bill of Rights. Nobody in the first Congress tells us why they voted for a Bill of Rights. Maybe I'm misspeaking. He doesn't tell us why he wrote the Second Amendment. Nobody in Congress tells us why they supported the Second Amendment. But it seems entirely sensible that Madison would decide, he's right, he's doing this for political reasons, principally for political reasons, that he would attempt to cure this supposed problem that Patrick Henry beat him senseless with in Virginia about you've given Congress the ability to disarm our militia. Now, Madison was, he vowed, I'm not going to write anything in the Bill of Rights that violates any of the terms in the Constitution. I'm going to just supplement the Constitution, not change it. So he couldn't say, well, the states have a concurrent power to arm the militia, because the main body of the Constitution gave that power to Congress. But the states didn't arm their militia, almost never. What the states did is they enacted laws that said militiamen shall show up at drills and musters with a weapon, with a musket or a rifle. That's how the militia were armed, just by laws that said militiamen bring a musket or a rifle with you. They didn't all do that because they didn't all have muskets or rifles. And you know, when we get to the War of 1814. It's like 20% of militias show up with a musket. But that's how militia were armed. So it wasn't a stretch to say a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And incidentally, a proposed amendment to change security of a free state to defense was defeated, because everybody understood they were talking about internal security, not national defense. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What it did is to say, well, the people can militiamen can arm themselves. And that was the cure to the problem. We can have an armed militia because militiamen can arm themselves. And so the states have a right to an armed militia, and we're protecting that by saying militiamen can arm the militia, which is what was going on then at the time anyway. And I think nobody thought it was a big deal. Patrick Henry and George Mason had raised this bugaboo, this monster in the closet, this monster under the bed, that Congress is going to disarm the militia to subvert the slave system. I don't think Madison believed that was a real worry. But he cures the worry by writing the Second Amendment.
Not to beat a dead horse, but I like the Bill of Rights. But products liability attorneys, like you and I, in a sense, you know, I've done scuba diving releases and skiing releases. But if you leave out of the release the fact that, hey, I waived the right to bring a lawsuit because my instructor is a convicted felon, it's not going to be in there. But you could base a really good case on that. And that is that argument that, yeah, maybe you won't have the right to drink milk, but you don't know. Other than the fact that liberal Supreme Courts have created this penumbra, rights that are unenumerated are still protected. But you and I, for the rest of our lives, I don't even know why I'm saying this, but you and I, for the rest of our lives, are going to be dealing with a 6-3, at best, Supreme Court.
Yes, that's certainly right. That's right. And unfortunately, Heller, which was the case in 2008, it said for the first time, take this amendment that Madison and the first Congress drafted and adopted and the states ratified. Take this amendment, take a pair of scissors, cut it in half, and take half of it and throw it in the wastebasket because it no longer means anything. Right. When it's a long been a canon of construction, statutory construction anyway, that nothing is deemed to be irrelevant or surplusage. You consider everything to be meaningful in a statute. You consider the whole statute, everything in it to be meaningful. And Scalia in Heller, Scalia is was a very, very smart man. And he makes an argument as to why you should ignore half of that amendment. But it's just a very clever argument by a very smart person. Nobody who read the Second Amendment at the time would think half of it doesn't mean anything.
That's my letter. Yeah, it never made any sense. It, you know, if you're intelligent and have common sense, doesn't make any sense. But, and you know, the Federalist guy, and it's funny they're called Federalists, but they would have been anti-Federalists at the time. You know, as we wind down here, I guess the last thing I would ask you is, you know, you were, when you were working here in Philadelphia, an advocate. Now you're an academic, unless I'm misstating it.
No, and, you're right.
And so you're an academic. You've written this book. It's a great book. I learned so much from it. But this is a question a bookseller always gets, and I always ask is like, okay, what do I take away from it? Is it a closed end ending? Or do I think about it, come up with my own thoughts? And is there anything that I can do proactively that's going to do anything?
All right, that's a great question. And I have what might not be a completely satisfying answer, but it is an answer. The Supreme Court, as you pointed out, is 6-3. And it's 6 conservatives. And and it was 5-4 when Heller was decided. It's been 6-3 when the most recent Second Amendment case, Bruin, was decided. And Sam, I hope you and I both live a very, very long life, but probably in our lifetime, the Supreme Court is not going to change the interpretation of the Second Amendment, which is the militia's got nothing to do with it. The security of a free state's got nothing to do with it. It's all about giving people the right to own weapons for their own purposes, regardless of whether they're in the militia.
I always think I'm at the end, you know, but I'm not. I never can close these interviews.
Yeah, let me just finish this.
All right, go ahead. Finish it.
Let me just finish this. I don't think that's going to change in our lifetime. But some old Scot once said, if I could make the songs, I would not care who could make the laws. Meaning, politics and law is driven by culture, by public belief, not the reverse. And so I do believe that over time, if the American public comes to understand the Second Amendment was not some sacred bequest from the founders about freedom and liberty. That isn't what it was. The Second Amendment was not about protecting the musket in the hands of the Minuteman on Lexington Green as a check against tyranny. That isn't what it was. The Second Amendment was about protecting the musket in the hands of the slave patroller in the South. That's what it was about. If people realize that, their view of the Second Amendment will change, and eventually law and politics about and policy about the Second Amendment will change too. So I wrote the book not as a instant cure, but for the long run.
Yeah, and it's good because it gives a foundation and a baseline from which you can draw it. Yeah, that's it. It gives you a baseline and a foundation that we didn't know about prior to reading it. And that gives you an avenue into a thought process that might lead to an evolution. Yeah. Okay. That's okay. I have other questions, but that's a perfect ending, right?
All right. Thank you, Sam. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.